Accession number 28351, reel 17.
Reel 16.
And that has led to a lot of trouble. Khodorkovsky, who is still in jail, is the most striking example. I don't know whether he's done anything wrong or not, but it looks as though there is a state trial going on, which cannot be good for stability. And you've got now the owner of Chelsea Football Club, the Russian multi-millionaire, so billionaire several times over, I think. He was the one of the people who were very quick to take advantage of the situation. That's led to resentment, and the instability of Russia, and one hears of people who formerly depended with certainty on getting the state pension every week or every month, whatever it was, who are now really uncertain whether they're going to get it next week, because the situation is still trying to settle down. I don't know that the Russians would have accepted more advice from the West at the relevant time. It would have been better if the West had given Russia more advice. I don't know what the reception would have been. But we could have helped them to make the transition to capitalism more smoothly. It would have had to be more slow, because the whole thing was built up, and that's led to a lot of the subsequent problems.
I suppose with somebody like Yeltsin in charge, this must have been a factor, mustn't it? He was sort of going wholesale into this. And it did seem, from sort of reading about the situation, that the West were very much behind this privatisation of the state industries and getting this done very quickly. I wonder how much we were to blame this rush.
I don't know the answer to that. I did not get the impression that we were pushing the Russians to do it faster. I'm not sure there would have been any advantage for us if they'd done so. I think our interest lay in stability and a steady transition which is going to be lasting and fruitful and lead to democracy. The trouble now, one of them, is that Putin is reverting to traditional Russian stance in relation to human rights. He's driven, of course, by the problem of Chechnya, where there is great fighting and very nasty things are happening. Well, my perception is that he attaches enormous importance to this and to crushing the Chechen rebellion. But that's only the beginning, because there are other central Asian or states, in inverted commas, in the proximity of Chechnya, which also are looking for separation, two little enclaves looking for separation from Georgia. Lots of potential for trouble there. The Georgians, having asserted their right to be a democracy and apparently doing rather well, are suffering from these independence movements from their two little countries on their border with Russia.
Because it ties up with your independence argument.
Yes, that's right. Another example of the desire for independence all over the place.
Yes.
So Russia's going to have lots of problems. I don't actually see it moving more in a democratic direction in the near future. I think the tendency is likely to be towards more central control, because these pressures of Chechnya and other disturbing political factors will push them in that direction.
Do you think there's too much emphasis by politicians like George Bush, for instance, in the United States, on pushing countries into their version of democracy without perhaps understanding the history and cultures of these different countries?
I think that probably is an error, to the extent that George Bush is doing it now, because I suspect that it may that it's popular with many people, it may arouse resentment from quite a number of countries. And you see, you've got the case now in Uzbekistan, where Karimov, the president, is very much in charge of a ruthless dictator, but he seems to have control. Is it actually going to help the Uzbeks to achieve democracy, to go on criticizing such regimes? I don't know. I don't know that situation fully. But there are going to be some very difficult decisions to be taken by the West in connection with how far we push for democracy. I think George Bush is wrong, and was wrong, when he propounded his Middle East plan for democracy. You may remember when the Iraq war was being contemplated, that he painted a picture of democracy spreading right across the Middle East. Well, those who know the Middle East much better than I do see that as entirely unrealistic, because it's not a sort of state of affairs that the Middle Eastern countries are at all familiar with. It takes a long time, actually, to get it right in forming democracy. So I think that George Bush, I wouldn't say is going to come a cropper, but his vision of a democratic Middle East is going to be very far from what actually happens. And I suppose that would be embarrassing to the United States. But it does have this mission to improve the world. The United States is such an extraordinary creation, such a successful creation itself. It seems to assume that other countries are capable of doing what it has done. And the fact is they're not, most of them.
And the nuclear issue today, you know, disarmament, what are your hopes or fears on that? Given the fact that America is now pushing Star Wars again to the concern of the Soviet Union and, of course, other states as well. I don't know how you feel with your vast experience in this field.
I don't think that it's worthwhile pursuing Star Wars. I think it's very doubtful that it's going to work. I think it was useful in the days when Reagan was talking about it, because, as I said, it did help to lead to the collapse of the Soviet Union and Soviet communism. But I don't think it's needed. And it's going to be less needed the more America leaves behind other countries, including the Soviet Union, industrially and technically and scientific success. So what country is Star Wars going to be needed against? I can't see it. But if you're asking about nuclear proliferation, that is a serious worry. We've already got, we think, in Israel a nuclear state, India and Pakistan nuclear states, Korea and Iran. Korea, a wholly unpredictable country in terms of what it's likely to do, of a rather terrifying kind, ruled by a ruthless man who's suppressing his own people ruthlessly, and is isolated in such a way that I don't think he listens to the outside world, possibly listens a little bit to China. But I think that everything must be done to discourage him from moving in that direction. I think that it's doubtful whether the Americans are playing that problem in the right way. I think that they have been very negative in insisting that Korea does makes a lot of concessions before America responds. I think they should be more forthcoming, and I think that's also true in the case of Iran. In Iran, they're saying they won't give any help, as I understand it. Essentially, they won't give any help until Iran has given very full undertakings. It's going to be very difficult to get either North Korea or Iran to take the first steps. I mean, it's very important that a continuing effort should be made. I think the more nuclear powers there are, military nuclear powers, there are, the worse, the more dangerous the world is going to get. And we have to assume that one day, if you have a really irresponsible state, they're going to let off a nuclear weapon. I'm optimistic about the relationship between Pakistan and India, because I think that they have now realized how stupid it is to go on quarreling, even over Kashmir, which is a highly provocative subject for both sides. I think they are beginning to see that the cause of wisdom, while they won't give up their nuclear weapons, is not to even to threaten to use them, though they have actually threatened.
Do you think the economic dynamism of India is a factor here? It's, you know, made such in India economically.
Yes.
And do you think it feels a little more sort of secure? And is that a factor?
I don't know the situation well enough. It could well be a factor. Yes, a bit of confidence might be a good thing. Certainly they're coming along very fast. And that, I think, is fast as the Chinese, who are phenomenal.
Is that very
yes.
China? And what's your view of the rise of China economically? You know, how you feel this is going to impact on world politics and issues of war and peace as well, that you're so concerned?
China I know a bit better than I know India, because I was born in Hong Kong and my parents were there for many years. I'm optimistic about China. They are very keen to retain a sort of empire which they've already got, that is to say, over Tibet and the Uyghurs, for you know who they are, in the western parts of China. But I don't think we have reason to expect them to go to war against anybody, apart from Taiwan, possibly. That is a real risk. And my own feeling about Taiwan is that the Americans are unwise to give such support to Taiwan. I think that it all dates back to Chiang Kai-shek and Madam Chiang Kai-shek, who was a great success in Washington society many years ago, persuaded the American leadership that she was a wonderful person. And America rather fell in love with Taiwan for that reason. But I think that Taiwan, as Taiwan says, with some exceptions, Taiwan wants to rejoin the mainland. And I think that's the natural thing to happen. And I hope it's not going to happen by force. Although if Taiwan does actually declare independence, I don't put it beyond the Chinese to react very vigorously. But otherwise, I think China is going to be an enormous success economically. They're going ahead at colossal speed. They are quick learners. They're very intelligent people. And they will go on growing by something like 8% a year in their GDP, which is what they're doing at the moment. It doesn't take long, 8% a year for a few years, to be enormously powerful. They're not going to outdo the Americans economically for quite a while. That's amazing. So China's got a lot of catching up to do.
What about Japan and the sort of balance of power in that area? You know, Japan still ahead, isn't it? Although it's had its problems.
Still ahead economically. Yes, but I think China's catching up. I don't have the figures on that, but my impression is China's catching up, and of course the population of China is enormously bigger than that of Japan. Japan is 200 million or something like that. China is a billion. That's about as is India now, approaching China's population. So you've got two countries out there with colossal growth ahead of them. But I'm optimistic about they're not going to war in both cases, apart from the risk about Taiwan.
With all these conflicts and problems and really changes in the world, you're now in the House of Lords. How would you rate the level of debate on these issues? You have explained that, you know, foreign affairs is debated, but do you think a real contribution is made by the House of Lords? And I suppose this brings us to the role of the House of Lords today. And I know I've been coming to see you now for many months, haven't I? And often it's been difficult to get an appointment because you've been so very busy, which makes me think that there's a lot of activity in the Lords and people do take it very seriously. Is that right?
I very much enjoyed our meetings, I would like to say. Yes, there is a lot of activity in the Lords about international affairs. I have been very busy because that is my main interest. If my main interest has been, say, housing, I would have been much less busy than I've been, and I would have been attending the House of Lords less. I think the level of debate in the House of Lords is high, and what is more, it's listened to. I was in the Commons for 28 years, and my impression of the Commons now is it's not any better than when I was there, maybe possibly a bit worse, in the sense that the debates are not all that rational. In the Lords, you have to be very careful in preparing your speech or your question, because you know that there is bound to be somebody in the chamber who knows more than you do about that particular subject, almost certainly, whatever it is, science, international affairs, medicine, industry, finance, the whole lot. There's an immensely wide range of expertise, and it's deployed quietly but rationally, a sort of grunt, if there is a grunt of approval, maybe, is occasionally heard, but that's about all. Nobody ever shouts. To raise one's voice would be regarded as very bad behaviour. So the debates are much more coherent than they are in the Commons, and they're very well informed because of the wide variety of knowledge. We had, as an example, we had a question recently about the dues paid by shipping for the maintenance of the lighthouses around the coast of this country. And one of the members on the Labour bench, the minister answered the question, and one of the Labours on the back benches on the Labour side rose to say, well, he used to be a lighthouse keeper, so he could speak with authority. And I thought, well, that's rather interesting. You wouldn't find that in the Commons. And then somebody rose on our side, the Conservative side of the House, to say he was actually the Commissioner of Lights in Northern Ireland. So we had one on each side. You would never get that sort of thing in the House of Commons. And the trouble is now in the House of Commons is that it is becoming more and more, not only, I think, more noisy, but also more an area or a house in which lots of people are very similar in the background. And the similarity lies in their having been political advisors to ministers or to backbenchers. And the political advisor now, increasingly, on leaving university, goes straight into politics. And I think that's a pity. I think it's a great thing for people who want to go into politics to have some other experience so that they can actually speak from personal knowledge, and that is diminishing. So I think that the House of Lords is very important. I'm not in favour of an elected House. You can imagine that may could be because I'm an appointed member. But I don't think an elected House would be an advantage, so there is a certain amount of support for that, quite a lot of support for that, because it would be a repetition of the House of Commons. So if you want a House of Lords which is going to be prepared to defy the House of Commons from time to time when it's appropriate, you want a House which contains people who are there for life and don't have to worry about an election and whether they are towing the party line. If you had an elected House, it would contain only people elected or put forward by a party, one party or another. And that would mean that after 5 years or whatever the voting period, they might be dropped from the party list if they didn't toe the party line. So you're going to have much less chance of successful opposition from the Lords, which is certainly necessary quite often, whatever the government. Much less chance of that opposition if you have an elected House. I don't know that this has been properly thought through by those in the House of Commons who do support that point of view. William Hague, when he was leader of the Conservative Party, favoured an elected house. I didn't agree with that at all. I think that the Conservative Party's gone quiet on that issue now. I think for the reason that I've just been giving, that they realise that what is happening now is that the House of Lords, as at present composed, is actually a very effective critic of business coming to it from the House of Commons, and that is dependent on security of tenure and on the wide variety of knowledge. There was a letter in the Times newspaper two or three years ago when this subject was being debated, which described the House of Lords as unrepresentative and lacking authority. And I disagreed strongly with that view. If it lacks authority, it's because of legislation. I mean, the Lords can't, in the last ditch, prevail over the Commons. As the Lord says, it can't do that. But if you look at the wide types of experience, I wrote a letter in reply to this leader in the Times saying, I was sitting in the chamber at question time this morning or this afternoon, and I looked around the house and I saw a dentist, a lighthouse, former lighthouse keeper, several field marshals, and some distinguished scientists, people from industry, people from finance, people with knowledge of foreign countries. And you couldn't possibly match that in the House of Commons. They wouldn't get anywhere near
it. These debates, which you've described so well, you know, the level of knowledge and the quiet, rational debates, the outcome, the sort of results of these debates, is there a way of feeding that through and getting the House of Commons, the people who make the legislation, to listen to what you have to say? Are you listened to enough, do you think?
No. Neither House knows enough about the other. When the reform of the House of Lords was being debated a couple of years ago, I listened to a talk by a Labour member who was calling for a directly elected House of Lords, who was quoting, amongst other things, the fact that the House of Commons goes in for pre-legislative consideration of a number of bills, under the impression the House of Lords doesn't do it. It's been doing it for some time. That is an example of the ignorance in the Commons of the Lords. I'm not saying people in the Lords know much about the Commons unless they've actually served there, but there are quite a lot of those who have done that. So this is one of the problems. And the other thing is that the media are very ignorant, apart from very few exceptions, about the House of Lords, because they don't attend debates. The press gallery in the Lords is very seldom much occupied. In the Commons, of course, it is all the time. And the Commons is the chamber with the power in the last resort, and that's really the chamber that makes the news. It's also the chamber which gives the more excitement and drama because of the rows that happen there. So you don't have much drama in the House of Lords, which I suppose makes it less interesting for the media.
I think there's been quite a bit of drama, though, the last few months before the election, with the Lords debates, which were reported on the anti-terrorist bill. I know you were involved because you put me off a couple of times.
Well, that was a very dramatic affair on an enormously important subject in which there was very deep interest. And the media fastened onto that and really took a very, very keen interest. That was a very exceptional, a very useful example of what the House of Lords can do. And I think House of Lords on the whole was right. And it came out of it, I thought, I suppose, reasonably well, in the sense that he did get a consensus from the government that this whole question is going to be looked at again. That was a matter of human rights, really, which the media are rather keen on. Though, regrettably, I have to say that was an exception.
But it did seem to a lot of people that the Lords were speaking for the public rather than the Commons.
Oh, yes, they were indeed. I had quite a lot of letters on that. It's interesting that peers do get more correspondence now. When I went to the Lords 12 years ago, I said to myself, well, at least I won't have the same volume of correspondence that I've had in the House of Commons. Well, I don't actually get that volume, but I do get quite a lot, depending on the subject. If you have a social question, or you have this terrorism question, or if you have something like the proposed bill to ban incitement to religious hatred, which I heard was repeated in the Queen's speech the other day, then there'll be a lot of interest in that. I had a lot of correspondence about that. I had a lot of correspondence about the mental capacity bill. That sort of social issue arouses a lot of interest amongst a lot of people around the country. It doesn't necessarily arouse much interest in the media, but as far as the country is concerned, one gets quite a lot of correspondence on subjects of that kind.
Well, I can see you need your word processor.
Yes, I do. I also
need
technology instruction how to use it.
So that's the end of Reel 16, Lord Peter Blaker.